This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, and today I'm speaking to a man who has served on three U.S. presidential campaigns, including two which ended up in the White House. Former Obama campaign strategist Roger Fisk. Thank you for coming on the show, Roger.
Thank you, Lynn. I'm so happy to be here.
So you've served on three presidential campaigns, the first one under former Secretary of State John Kerry, who at the time was the senator for Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. How did that prepare you for subsequently working as well on the Obama campaign?
Interesting question. It was my first presidential campaign. So I had worked a lot of campaigns in Massachusetts, and in the course of the early kind of building blocks of the Kerry presidential run, a lot of us had been sent off to other races in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and things like that. So that the campaign itself was really my first time to go out into the homes and union halls and arenas and community centers of Iowa and Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan and Florida and all those things. And it was amazing. It was heartbreaking the way it all went. But it gave me the foundation to then move on to the next presidential campaign 4 years later. And by then I had the tools. I knew a little bit more about the rhythms and the requirements and the pressures of a presidential campaign. So the interesting conundrum for me has always been I so much wanted John Kerry to win, but had John Kerry won in 2004, there wouldn't have been a Barack Obama in 2008, right? So you never know how things are going to work out.
It's true. And so the Obama campaign was quite unusual, I suppose, in its use of technology at the time. Mm-hmm. In his campaigns in 2008 versus 2012, social media presented a major shift in platforms of how he spread his ideas. How did you begin navigating that, first in 2008 and subsequently when he ran for re-election?
Sure. It's really interesting. In 2008, we were still mainly living in kind of a desktop world, mm-hmm. and social media was still in its infancy. Fast forward to 2012, and the smartphone had come. The smartphone really came out in the middle of the first campaign. But by 2012, people were completely liberated from the desktop experience.
Right. I think smartphone penetration had more than doubled in that time between 2008 and 2012 in the U.S.
Exactly. So we went from our organizing tool, our online organizing tool in the first campaign was called MyBarackObama.com, where basically very similar to how you would sign up for a free email account or something. You put in some basic demographic information. In the first campaign, we were trying to bring people to one specific platform that had tentacles that reached out to the very embryonic versions of Twitter and things like that. In the second campaign, due to the proliferation of platforms and apps, it was more about pushing our content out into these many, many dozens of places where people were getting their information and living their online lives. For me, was such an interesting experience. Is how do you stay true to the organizational values that you had as a startup, and how do you navigate these massive, seismic, technological changes, sociological changes, and stay true to those values that defined you when it was just a couple dozen people, but have the ability and the capacity to scale up to thousands of employees and things like that, and adapting to that technology while still maintaining those core values. Really, really interesting.
Mm. How did the information that you needed to disseminate change with the advent of Twitter, Facebook?
You know, the tonality of the exercises are different, and then the technology that we used was different. The first campaign was largely introductory. Mm. We had to spend 2007. I joined in January of 2007 and traveled 25 states just in that year. And what we were trying to do was to go out and introduce the country to Barack Obama and at the same time try to take some of the air out of the narrative that we were a long shot and that we didn't have a chance. So like the viability kind of threshold is what we kind of called it. And then 2008 was once it was the general election and it was us versus Senator McCain, it kind of crystallized into a I'm simplifying, but I think it's accurate that it crystallized into kind of a fundamental dynamic of yesterday versus tomorrow. Fast forward to 2012, and then we have all the – we're no longer aspirational, right? We're no longer talking about what we will do or might do or want to do. You then have a four-year record to defend, and you have achievements and accomplishments that have frustrated some people, have made other people happy, have alienated other people. So the tonality of the races were different. The technology involved was different. And then the responsibilities and the expectations and the burdens on Barack as an individual were different. Well, he's the same throughout is the funny thing, which is probably one of the most important lessons to take from it all.
Mm. But how much were you still reliant on the traditional platforms like TV, newspaper advertising, and how much did that shift towards social media in the 2012 campaign?
We called it new media. So we didn't even call it digital or social. We just called it new media. And I've always maintained, and I think I've proven this in the work that I've done since, that new media is strongest when it's combined with old media. There's nothing more powerful than a campaign that reaches people in many, many different touch points in their life. So you pick up that morning newspaper, you watch that evening news, you listen to the radio while you're driving, you listen to a podcast like yours, on. And if you can establish a presence in all those different touch points in people's lives that are all based on those core strategic values, you know, that that defined us as a startup, that's how you really engage millions of people in big ideas. I think a lot of people tend to lunge towards new tools and new apps and just kind of embrace them because they're new. That's why a lot of businesses and brands end up with 6 and 7 different social media platforms without really doing any of them well. So the fascination with the new is healthy, but I would always counsel that people look at the value and the potential impact of those new tools as resting on a foundation of some of the old tools. That to me is the most powerful, comprehensive way to do a real campaign.
Mm. Now, in order to fully utilize new media in conjunction with the old media, as you're describing, of course, you need money. And a big part of being on the campaign trail is not just about gaining support for the eventual vote, but it is also raising money to essentially self-sustain. And President Obama was the first major party presidential candidate to refuse support from the Presidential Public Funding Program. And he did it again in 2012. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us what was the rationale for that initially?
Well, there's a blessing and a curse with that, because if you take that money, you're capping your ability to raise other money. And we looked at each individual as not just a single persuasion exercise. We looked at each individual as A, a potential organizer, and B, a relationship, meaning we're going to be with this person a year from now, we're going to be with this person 2 years from now, 4 years from now, 6 years from now. And that sounds like a small thing, but once you start to think of people that way, it makes the organization behave much differently, and it makes how you view and value that individual much more a part of the cultural values that started the whole campaign, which was all based on giving people the tools to organize people in their lives. And that same startup mentality continued on into 2012. For example, when we built an SMS-based donate tool to accommodate young people and getting away from computers and going mobile and all those things. So the tools changed, but the organization remained the same. We just constantly were adapting.
Okay. Aside from that, also using, I believe, data analytics, President Obama was able to raise over $1 billion. And I'm just curious as to how you went about that and how that data subsequently guided your ad placement.
Absolutely. We did really, really interesting things. Talking about old tools and new tools, we used that data to drill down into specific demographics and specific areas of the country, so that we would do things like we would buy ads on very specific bus routes, for example, where down to the actual street level of knowing where our voters were.
Wow.
Some of the other things we did that were really interesting, was we didn't do national television buys, which all of our opponents did. They had a much more 20th century approach to these things. Mm-hmm. We bought on regional and local cable systems, which allowed us to make much more strategic decisions on a month-by-month basis instead of putting a lot of money into large national ad buys. That provided us a lot of agility. And then we found things like if you looked at certain parts of the country – where people were still working second and third shifts, mm-hmm. you could drill into specific shows that aired at 1 or 2 in the morning, and you could find people that were getting off work from their second shift, and you could find a way where you could, for pennies on the dollar, get your message directly in front of the people that you needed to reach. And that was all – I mean, part of it is the entrepreneurial spirit and the startup mentality that we held on to even once we were quite big. But part of it is also using those tools to help you find where are your people and how are we going to activate them and how are we going to reach them.
I'm speaking to Roger Fisk, former strategist to the Obama presidential campaigns. We'll continue our discussion on U.S. election campaigns in just a little while, so stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Roger Fisk, former Obama campaign strategist and veteran of three U.S. presidential campaigns. So, Roger, before this, we were talking about the role that social media played over the course of the 2008 and 2012 Obama campaigns. But what are your thoughts on the 2016 elections? How would you describe Donald Trump's campaign strategies?
Well, I was first off, I'm from the other side of the aisle, obviously. Mm-hmm. I was neither a Clinton guy nor a Sanders person. So I wasn't involved in that race at all. To be analytical and to try to look at this in a Socratic way, he tapped into a lot of anger. And anger to me is easy. For example, I'm also a musician. I grew up, you know, in bands and stuff. And at some point, even if you're an angry punk rocker, at some point you reach some life milestone, either you get married or you have your first kid or something. You start to think that maybe there's something about life that you should start to kind of emphasize what you're for and not just what you're against. So to me, his candidacy and in many ways his presidential tenure thus far has been just one long sustained primal scream. That does not necessarily have policy or even moral underpinnings. And unfortunately, the people that signed up and looked upon him as a potential savior for the diminishing manufacturing base and any number of other things, I don't think those their wishes or the reasons that they voted for him have manifested. But to be fair, he has two more years, so we'll see.
I suppose whatever else you say about him, he has wound up a very charismatic figure to a certain demographic. And he ran a leaner campaign compared to others on the campaign trail with him, Bernie Sanders, for example. But he got a lot of media coverage simply for his controversial stance on topics.
Right.
Right.
And, so, and also, I mean, he's great TV.
He is.
I mean, you know,
yes.
I watched him. You know,
yes.
So, like, he's great TV.
Yeah, so he already had a basis because of The Apprentice. So people already knew who he was, even though he was a challenger.
Back to the 80s. Yeah. I mean, he had airlines and vodka and steaks and bankruptcies and casinos. I mean, he was around for a while.
I mean, that playing into the broader media fascination for the controversial, do you think this was a planned strategy or was it just a byproduct of his essential personality?
I don't think when he embarked on his campaign that he expected that he would win. I think he looked at it as a way to enhance his brand. And so I think he was looking for, you know, what's the next lap around the track that's going to keep me relevant and on TV and in people's faces. And then it was a horrible field. And then the fact that, you know, and I say this with admiration, the fact that he is such good television, you know, there was no one on those debate stages that could even, you know, get a word in edgewise in terms of like how these things were covered and everything. Everyone covered Trump. He was great TV. He said outrageous things and, you know, all these different things. So that and the other 15 or 16 Republicans tended to just kind of self-immolate in a lot of ways.
And now looking forward a little, we've just seen the midterm elections come and go, and now we're gearing up for the 2020 presidential race, which currently looks to be everyone versus Trump.
Even you, Lynn, you could run.
Maybe I could. Social media will once again be in the spotlight, especially after the accusations of Russian interference in the 2016 elections, and also because Facebook is reevaluating its regulations on political advertising. So what would you like to see Facebook do from your position working in the campaigns in order to curb election meddling?
Well, it's very interesting to watch how they've behaved in this. And I know some people that work there. And actually, Chris Hughes, one of the original founders, one of Zuckerberg's roommates at Harvard, who was one of the founders of Facebook, developed MyBarackObama.com. Mm. So there's some common shared kind of DNA there. The drip, drip, drip of we lost X number of people's, you know, private information. And then 6 weeks later, it's we lost another 29 million. And then 6 or 8 weeks later, it's we were hacked and like on and on. Facebook needs to like almost shut down for like a week or something like that. And then come back to the American people and do a full mea culpa in terms of like this is where our weaknesses have been. This is our best, most comprehensive, full sense of where we have lost track of people's information or where we've been compromised, things like that. Just like in any other dynamic, having story after story after story is not the way you want to run a big major national or international brand. I also think, you know, the transparency is the key. So I think it should be that you could click on someone's profile, especially an organization, and be able to see some kind of verifying address or some kind of way that they register so that they prove that they actually exist. And that they're an actual group of people that can be identified and held accountable. This kind of shadow stuff. For example, even if you gave $10 to the Obama campaign, you still were registered as a donor. If you gave the most money or you gave a dollar, you still had to register and we were still transparent. You could go through and see every single person who ever gave Barack Obama a penny, period. And I think that same sense of transparency would do well. I don't know what the tool is or how you achieve that. But Facebook is hemorrhaging Gen Xers. Facebook is hemorrhaging young parents. And it's also not bringing in new users in that pipeline. So their challenges are multiple. I'm not a billionaire, so obviously they know a lot more than I do. But I do think that having some kind of mechanism and process so that people could have a sense that they've tried to scrutinize themselves thoroughly would be very healthy for them and would restore some of the trust that I think they've lost.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit about U.S. Campaign finances, because it does touch a bit on Facebook and basically who is allowed to fund advertising, not necessarily on candidates themselves, but on issues which will have advocacy campaigns. Yeah. So the U.S. campaign finance laws changed greatly in between the Obama presidential campaigns, particularly in the wake of the Citizens United case and the case of Speech Now against the Federal Election Commission. So how did you navigate that changing landscape? What was the operational impact of the decisions?
Sure. We knew coming into 2012 that by virtue of that Supreme Court decision, we were going our opponent, and at the beginning of the campaign, we didn't know who the opponent would be, that we knew up to $500 million was going to be spent irrespective of whoever ended up being our opponent. So before we even got to the starting line, we knew $500 million roughly was going to be spent. I think that having limits on these things is completely right and justifiable. The advocacy thing is interesting because if you want to go out and say every child should have access to proper nutrition, you should be able to do that. The question is like, at what point does it morph from advertising to helping a specific individual's campaign? Mm-hmm. And I think that the vigilance around that and the level of standards for that need to be raised. So, for example, if you use the image of one of the people running for president while you're doing this advocacy campaign, that to me should be like a simple trigger, things like that. So there's a speech component to it where you don't want to just muzzle people and say you can't advocate for childhood nutrition. But at the same time, there needs to be a transparency element, and then there needs to be some relatively high standards for at what point does that advocacy campaign cross a line and become something that is a overt benefit to a specific campaign.
So now, what would you like to see in terms of political funding reform in the US? I ask this because Malaysia currently is looking into formulating our own political funding laws, and the conversation is really only still in its infancy. What are some of the areas that we should be looking at, and are there any potholes that we should be trying to avoid?
Well, limits, I think, are healthy. In terms of the individual, I don't think I wouldn't limit what a campaign could raise, but I would limit what an individual could give. There's a part of me that has a foot in kind of public financing because I kind of get it. I understand the motivation of it. But I still think that politics is still a marketplace of ideas. And I think you need to go out and hustle and earn people's support. And part of that is raising money. In terms of what you're working on now, the focus needs to be on the individual and the reporting requirements and the making sure that those are widely available and very easy to access online. But then also because, as we all know, there's many populations that still aren't even online. So you need to figure out a way in the town hall or the town clerk or some kind of component like that to see who's given what to whom, as well as the online component. And that's how I think you do it. But I would focus on putting actual donation limits on the individual and then high standards for transparency and reporting requirements and things like that on the organizations and the candidate themselves.
So are you planning to go back to advising for presidential campaigns anytime soon?
You know, you've been kind enough to mention that I've worked 3 presidential campaigns. And I was pretty sure I was done. And more importantly, Mrs. Fisk was pretty sure that I was done. But the severity of what's going on right now, I think, has brought me to maybe not consider working another presidential campaign in the context in the same way that I did before. But then there's some really interesting – I mean, we talked about some of the advocacy groups. So there's really interesting groups in that space that are, you know, progressive fundamentally on my side of the aisle that I'm really kind of interested in looking at, and because I don't think that all the answers come from campaigns themselves. However we can get people involved and activated and motivated and engaged and give real traction to their aspirations for the country, I think is healthy. There's 2 people, one who's in and one who's maybe about to be in, that I could picture myself working for. But then also that's up to them too.
So if you do go back to advising the campaigns for the 2020 race, what would be the key things you'd watch out for moving forward?
You know, the beauty of the Obama campaigns and him as an individual is there was a seamless arc between where we started, where we grew, how we developed those tools, who he was as an individual. So if you opened an email in 2007 and you got a text in 2012 and then you went to an event in 2017, there would actually be a narrative arc there of all still going back to the earliest organizational values that we started on. And my point in that is that you need to know exactly who you are. You need to know exactly why you are doing this. A lot of people that have run, I've seen, tend to shapeshift and react too much. So they pivot so many times that you look at them and you can just tell they don't even know what they're selling anymore. Is it change? Is it experience? Is it vision? Is it tomorrow? Is it tradition? Is it on and on and on? So what people need to do is crystallize things down to a very simple form. And then everything else after that needs to be based on that. And this applies to corporations as well. It's when you try to present yourself as something different than what you are that the trouble starts.
Thank you so much for being on the show today, Roger. I've been speaking to Roger Fisk, the former Obama campaign advisor, here today from the London Speakers Bureau. I'm Lynn Mark for The Morning Run on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Now with faster speeds every day. Baru la bes.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.